Are you one of the frightened? It must have happened to you at some time in your life. You meet a completely strange set of people. They come into your life just as suddenly as they leave, and they leave you to wonder for the rest of your days. Was it real? Did you dream them all up? And why were you chosen of all people to encounter them? Here, have a glass of port while I tell you the strange story of Henry Harper, a traveling salesman. It was in Shanghai, I think, shortly after the Second World War, that Henry Harper had his curious experience. Now, Henry Harper was a rug salesman, which has very little to do with the story, except perhaps to explain that he was a man who was used to hotels, sleeping away from home, and constantly traveling in strange cities far from his native London. So it was that Henry Harper found himself in an obscure Shanghai hotel, a guest for one night. In the morning, he had an important appointment with one of the wealthiest dealers in the city. Henry Harper was tired. The noisy, jostling Shanghai streets, a veritable melting pot of races, creeds, and colors, had given him a headache. His eyeballs were scorched from the afternoon sun. So it was that when night came, Henry Harper was more than ready for bed. He'd unpacked all his luggage, attired himself in pajamas, and read himself to sleep, as has been his custom for many years. But he had fallen asleep with the lights on. It was perhaps an hour or two later that Henry Harper stirred restlessly in his bed. His eyes were still closed, but a curious scratching noise came to his ears. Now, Shanghai's street noises had abated somewhat. Now the scratching sound filled the tiny hotel room. Henry Harper sat erect peevishly and opened his eyes to see what the disturbance was. Well, he was hardly prepared for the sight that greeted him. Seated at the dresser in the room, just at the foot of his bed, her back to him, was a lovely Eurasian woman, busily combing her hair as nice as you please. The woman's hair was fantastically long, its black length trailing down her shoulders to the floor. Henry Harper could only gape as the comb in the lady's hand ran briskly through the beautiful hair with easy feminine strokes. It was the noise of the comb drawing through the hair that had awakened Henry Harper. Before he could open his mouth to speak to the lady, she encountered some difficulty. The comb became snarled in the clump of her hair. Without a moment's hesitation, the lady lifted her head off her shoulders and disentangled the comb from her hair. Henry Harper had seen enough. With terror chilling his brain, he sprang out of bed and flung into the room next to his like a wild man. Four bland Chinese were seated round a dealing table having a quiet game of cards. Henry screamed to them about the woman in his room who had removed her head before his very eyes. The four Chinese smiled up at Henry Harper. "Oh, that," they said in chorus, "that's nothing. We can all do that." Whereupon they all, in turn, lifted their heads off their shoulders. So you see, Henry Harper had quite an experience. Of course, no one at the sanitarium believes this, but there you are. I suppose people always expect traveling salesmen to have a lot of funny stories to tell. Oh, by the way, help yourself to a cigar while I step through the wall here and go down to the cellar for another bottle of port. I do hate to take the long way.
Boris Karloff there, kicking off this horror-themed episode of the Sleazecast with one of his tales of the frightened. But before we go any further, let's hear from DJ Dr. Toast and one of his spooky remixes. This one entitled Day of the Dead Remix. I think I first encountered horror films way, way back when I was 9 or 10, when for some reason I was allowed to stay up and watch an old Universal horror movie, The House of Frankenstein, featuring our old friend Boris Karloff, not playing the monster this time. In this one, he was a mad scientist who revives the Frankenstein monster, played by Glenn Strange. House of Frankenstein was an excellent introduction to the classic Universal series. It featured most of the monsters in one film. The Wolfman, Dracula, turned up. Say the Frankenstein monster, and thrown in for good measure, of course, with a mad scientist played by Boris Karloff, and even a hunchback who assisted him, played by J. Carroll Nash, or Nash if I'm rightly, who interestingly was an Irish actor who never seemed to play Irishmen, played lots of Italians and Mexican bandits in his career, or even Chinese sometimes and Japanese. Also interesting there, of course, that it tells us some things. I always say pop culture is a fascinating insight to the attitudes of the times in which it was made, and reveals something about attitudes towards disability then, that a man to be afflicted with something as fortunate as a hunchback should be seen as being inherently evil. But from the House of Frankenstein, I started watching other horror films. And I think when I entered my early teens, horror became my thing when I was at school. Everybody else seemed to be into pop music or various bands they followed, or various TV shows very cultish that used to watch. Starsky and Hutch was very big. I remember one time in Charlie's Angels. But for me, it was horror movies, because nobody else seemed to be into them. It became my own proud little world, something I knew about and I was an expert on. And of course, in those days, horror films weren't recognised the way they are now. We didn't have critics back then telling us about the significance of Hammer films and the contribution they'd made to the British film industry in the 60s, or the artistic merits of the old Universal movies. None of that existed then. You were very much a lone voice if you liked horror films. Bit of a weirdo. Also at that time, that had been back in the mid to late 70s, coming to the early 80s as I got a bit older. There didn't seem to be many horror films being made. It seemed to be a genre very much in decline, particularly the old British Gothic horrors. Hammer Films was wheezing its last, producing mishits like To the Devil a Daughter, which just about finished off the old franchise. It couldn't compete with the new horror films being made, so much backed by studios like The Exorcist, The Omen, things like that. It just, Hammer just couldn't match them. I mean, already, you know, Tygon and Amicus already gassed their last some years before. So really, there wasn't a great deal being made. There was a few independent, low-budget independent horror films being made in this country. But really, it seemed to be a genre dying. And then, of course, it was revived by the appearance of Halloween in the States in, 1979, which changed everything, just as, to a certain extent, Night of the Living Dead had back in 68 when it first appeared. It set new rules for the horror genre, and things changed, and changed beyond my recognition of horror films. And it's then I started rather parting company with horror. But it wasn't surprising this happened. All the old tropes of horror seemed to run their course and run out of steam, and that was the problem. Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman. You know, they've been hammered, well, Dracula, Frankenstein particularly, been hammered staples for many years, variations on them. Whether they be lesbian vampires or whatever, they had variations on these themes. But gradually, they ran out of variations they could do on it, and basically, audiences were no longer interested in that sort of thing. These elaborate gothic horrors, and Hammer just couldn't change, unfortunately. It was all played out. Ah, but those were the days before the new monsters came in. Monsters that were often just us. Mad Men, zombies became popular, all that sort of thing. But we here at the Sleazecast, we have our own horror story to present to you today. A classic horror from one of the masters of the genre. Yes, we'd like to present to you from 1945, the US radio show Suspense's production of H.P. Lovecraft's The Dunwich Horror.
Play produced, edited, and directed by William Spear. Come in, Dunwich, Massachusetts. Come in, Dunwich.
Good evening. This is Henry Armitage. I'm speaking to you for... Dr. Rice, please close the window, will you? I'm speaking to you from my laboratory on the slopes of Sentinel Hill near Dunwich, Massachusetts. Present with me is Dr. Warren Rice, my distinguished colleague from Miskatonic University. We are now about 100 yards from the summit of the hill, which is crowned by a huge table-like stone set in the center of a circle of stone pillars, a place of prehistoric worship. A moment ago, you may have heard the dogs of Tunnage Township barking as we have heard them for 3 days and three nights. Dr. Rice and I know the horror which their barking portends, but the purpose of this broadcast is to make this unbelievable horror believable to you. I hope for your sakes and ours we are successful tonight. It is the eve of All Hallows. Tomorrow will be too late. Our time tonight is very short, so I'll speak only of those more recent events which, believe me, may culminate at any moment in a climax too frightful to wholly contemplate. I will begin with the birth of Wilbur Whately. It was the night of February the 2nd, 1921. Candlemas. Toward dawn, when Lavinia Whately, a deformed albino woman about 35 years old, gave birth to her dark, goatish-looking son in the crumbling Whately farmhouse northeast of the village. No one attended her. No doctor or midwife. No one was with her, except her aged, half-insane father, who was known as Wizard Whately. So Wilbur came into this world under heaven knows what incantations, what appeals to what powers. A week later, Wizard Whately drove his sleigh into Dunwich Village and reported the event to a group of loungers in Osborne's general store.
Hey, your grandson got yellow hair like Lavinia Wizard?
No, takes after his father more. He's dark, dark.
You never spoke of who his father might be now, did you?
Oh, you know his father when the time comes. Oh, Lavinia's read and seen some things the most of you only talk about. Calculate her husband's as good as you can find this side of Aylesbury.
We don't be nosy, Wizard.
Maybe it warn't in no church that none of you heard of. But you wouldn't ask no better church wedding than Lavinia's.
Well, I didn't hear tell of no wedding, Wizard. When was that?
Oh, not a wedding you'd hear of, Corey. Not a husband you'd hear of, neither. But let me tell you something. Someday you folks will hear a child of Lavinia's calling its father's name. On top of Sentinel Hill.
Prophecy? Or idle boasting by an insane old man? Oh, I know I ask a great deal when I ask you to believe that the arrival of an infant into that house of dire poverty and squalor could possibly constitute a horror and a threat to all our known world. Yet it has an earthly history. Perhaps through this history, you will be able to give it credence. Wilbur Whately's growth was uncanny. But even if he had been an average child, he would have become, in time, an unnatural being, for he was surrounded from the first by the most malign influences. There was his grandfather, old Whately, Wizard Whately, who each Halloween climbed Sentinel Hill to the great circle of stone, and while the hills shook, stood holding a great book open on his arms and shrieked into the wind. Shrieked.
Lord, jump off! Lord, jump off! Lord, jump off!
Yog-Sothoth. That dreadful name, first mentioned in the hideous forbidden book, the Necronomicon. And this Wizard Whately was Wilbur's teacher. The villagers began to notice curious things that were going on at the Whately farmhouse. Soon after Wilbur was born, old Whately began to remodel the house. The abandoned upper story was restored, and all the windows were tightly boarded up. And then, Wizard began to buy cattle in large numbers, both horses and cows. Yet the livestock on the farm didn't seem to increase. Young Lem Brown was one day curious enough to creep close to the house to count the Whately herd.
Dr. Armitage, there weren't more than 12 cows, and them sick. Looked like they had the blight and funny wounds on them, like cuts. I heard something, too, in the top part of Wizard's house. Something like water slapping inside. Only big. Big like a sea.
One other person went to the Whateley farm in the years before I met Wilbur. Dr. Ken Houghton of Aylesbury, who was called by Wilbur himself, who said that his grandfather was dying. Dr. Houghton found the old man in a bedroom on the ground floor, and Wilbur with him. While outside the window, a legion of whippoorwills cried loudly and rhythmically, endlessly. Wilbur spoke about the sound.
Certainly whistling time with his breathing now. They're ready. Listen, Doctor. They know his soul's going out. They're waiting.
Yes, Wilbur, that's an interesting superstition. Late in the year for them, too.
And when he goes, if they catch him, they'll keep laughing till break of day. If they don't catch him, they'll quiet down.
You mean you believe that... In just a minute. I think he's conscious.
Yes, the birds changed when his breathing changed. Like
Willie,
I say...
Willie!
I'm here.
More space, Willie. Remember, more space soon.
Yes, I'll build it.
You grows, but that grows faster. It'll be ready to serve you soon, Willie.
I know.
But remember, when it's time, you open up the gates to Yog-Sothoth with a long chant. The one on page 751 of the book. But mind you, feed it enough. Because if it gets out before you opens to Yog-Sothoth, it's all over. It's no use.
He's going now. He's dead, Wilbur.
Listen. The birds, they didn't get him. Yes, he's free. He's gone.
More from the Dunwich Horror later in the program. Only the other day I found myself trying to watch a modern horror film, well, reasonably modern. It was Sorority Row, a modern-day slasher pick. In fact, a remake of an earlier 80s slasher film, The House on Sorority Row. Unfortunately, it just couldn't hold my attention. I mean, it just seemed cliched. Everything was about it seemed identikit, from the US college setting to the interchangeable teenage characters to the non-surprising surprise denouement. Just seemed tired. Seen it all before. But, let's say, it's easy to criticise modern horror films if one is a fan of earlier horror, of an earlier cycle of horror films. I mean, I remember that when I was first getting seriously interested in horror films, I was quite shocked to find some critics in the 60s with a very early 70s that had a very dismissive attitude towards my beloved Hammer movies. They weren't held in high regard then. And saying they were nowhere near as good as these old black and white movies from the 40s and 50s. And one critic indeed dismissed Hammer, saying the worst they may have matched Universal in terms of their sheer number of films they produce. They haven't ever even reached the level of Monogram in terms of quality, which I thought was a grossly unfair comparison to make. But there you are. But it does seem to me, I mean, horror films increasingly, one criticism, they seem to be increasingly made for teenage audiences, for younger audiences. They seem to be increasingly self-parodying. But really, if we look back, is there anything new in that? Isn't that the way all cycles eventually end of any genre of film? After all, didn't the universal classic monster cycle culminate with Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, and Abbott and Costello meet the Mummy, Abbott and Costello meet Jekyll and Hyde? And even Hammer, my beloved Hammer films, after all, didn't they end up trying to remake Curse of Frankenstein, the original Frankenstein movie, as a black comedy, you know, Horror of Frankenstein in 1970? And poor old Dracula for Hammer ended up fighting Kung Fu vampire hunters out in the Far East in Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires. Perhaps, as I say, all horror cycles are destined to end that way. But enough of these speculations. Let's go over to the newsroom.
Hi, I'm Susie Sleaze with the latest horrific headlines. One of Britain's top mediums has told of her abusive marriage with a poltergeist and subsequent lesbian affair with a banshee. Brenda Spagger claims that it was her poltergeist husband's inability to satisfy her sexually that forced her into seeking solace elsewhere. That's the trouble with elementals. Their lack of actually physical presence means that relations are ethereal, to say the least, she reveals in her autobiography, I Married a Poltergeist. Apart from a bit of crude groping, the physical side has to be done by proxy. According to the medium, her husband was forced to manipulate dildos, vibrators and other sex aids in order to stimulate penetrative sex. However, she quickly found his lack of fairness dissatisfying. He was so rough, sending the bloody things flying through the air and ramming them into my orifices, she recalls. He wasn't too choosy about what he used, either. Kitchen implements, fruit, vegetables, anything which came to hand. I'd be bruised for days afterwards. How I longed for some tenderness and subtlety. As Spagger's reluctance to participate in relations with her husband became increasingly apparent, I couldn't bear the touch of his ectoplasm against my skin. He started to become violent. It was terrible. He'd hurl things at me. Crockery, furniture, even turnips, she claims. Eventually, I sought solace in the tender caresses of a banshee I'd met during a seance. However, the relationship with the banshee wasn't to last. Her constant wailing got on my tits, Spagger reveals. So I ditched her as well. Meanwhile, the Surrey woman is claiming that she has been receiving obscene phone calls from the late horror film star Vincent Price. It went on for several weeks, asserts 43-year-old Matilda Quimley. Those calls were quite a revelation, I can't tell you. Vincent Price may have come over as smooth and sophisticated in those Edgar Allan Poe films, but when he called me he was quite disgusting. The things he suggested. This isn't Quimley's first encounter with deceased classic horror movie stars. Last year she claimed to have enjoyed the Three in a Bed romp with Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, claiming that the latter had insisted on wearing his Dracula cape and biting her breasts. Karloff allegedly made her wear asphalt spreaders boots and walk up and down his back, apparently to ease his arthritis. When the former Frankenstein star later had trouble getting an erection, he apparently plugged himself into the mains. The result was astounding, Quimley asserts. One minute it was limp and flaccid, the next he had this huge glowing bone on with sparks flying off of it. I literally lit up when he stuck it in me. My hair stood on end. It was incredible. Evil is stalking Northamptonshire in the undead form of the vampirized Princess Diana, claims Bishop John Salford, Britain's self-styled top vampire hunter. Salford, the senior cleric in the West Midlands Catholic Church who plies his ministry via the internet, looks set to stir controversy with his new book, Die, Monsters, Die, in which he describes how he rescued an innocent young girl from the vampiric clutches of the princess, before attempting to lay her highness' unquiet spirit to rest by locating her unmarked grave in the grounds of Althorp House and driving a stake through her heart. Sadly, despite digging up her coffin, he was prevented from completing his mission by the arrival of the princess' brother, Lord Althorp, and a party of estate workers, who ejected him bodily from the grounds. Salford is currently on bail and facing charges of criminal damage after over 100 amateur vampire hunters descended on a Sheffield graveyard in April, following his appeal on local radio for help in hunting down another undead bloodsucker. Over 50 graves were dug up in the ensuing frenzy, with several bodies being staked and other remains being scattered across the cemetery. Salford remains unrepentant over the incident, pointing out that there has been no subsequent vampire activity in the area. That's all for now. More horrific news soon.
It was the winter following Wizard Whateley's death that I first met Wilbur. He came in person to the library at Miskatonic University to consult a copy of the hideous Necronomicon, which was kept there in its Latin version, as printed in Spain in the 17th century. I tell you, when he came into my office, I was appalled at his appearance. 8 feet tall, shabby, dirty, bearded. But I was even more appalled by his voice when he spoke to me.
I wrote you a letter a month past, Doctor. I wanted a loan of the book.
Well, that's a book that's never loaned from this library. I doubt if it is from any library.
Well, I have to see it, then.
Oh, very well. It's kept right here. As you know, there are only 3 copies of this book in existence. That's why we're careful. Here, you can look at it on this table.
Wizard said it would be on page 751.
What? What is it you're looking for?
The formula, the long chant. The one that opens the gate to Yog-Sothoth.
I felt a wave of fright as tangible as a draft from the tomb. It seemed, somehow, like the spawn of another dimension, like something only partly of mankind, linked to black gulfs beyond all spheres of force and matter, space and time. And presently he raised his head and spoke again.
It's here, all right, but I'll have to have a copy.
That paragraph there? I don't know.
You know Latin, Doctor?
Yes, certainly.
Then read it, Doctor. Let's hear how you make it out.
All right, that shouldn't be difficult. Let's see. Nor is it to be thought that man is the oldest or the last of Earth's masters. The old ones were, and the old ones shall be. Not in the spaces that we know, but between them. But only Yog-Sothoth knows the gate. Yog-Sothoth is the gate. To where the old ones broke through of old. Their hands are at your throats, yet ye see them not.
Dr. Armitage, you see, I reckon I've got to take that book home. There's things in it I've got to try, and you can't hold me up.
No, I'm sorry.
I tell you, Doctor, I'll have the book sooner or later, no matter what. You see, it that's waiting for me at home won't wait much longer.
It was a week later that I was awakened suddenly by the fierce yelping of the great watchdog on the campus, followed by a sound from a wholly different throat, a scream. I knew instantly that Wilbur had come back for the Necronomicon. I hastened into my clothes and rushed across to the library where a crowd had gathered before the smashed window of my office. Inside, there was a fearful groaning and growling, and some instinct warned me that what was taking place there was not for unfortified eyes to see. I brushed back the crowd, motioning only to Professor Rice to come in with me. When we opened the study door, Professor Rice screamed.
No, Dr. Armitage, no, I
come,
can't.
Come, close the door. We can't let them see. He's alive, but Lord, what a job that dog's done. Torn him to bits. Oh, that's a horrible sound, that moaning. Suppose we ought to call a doctor?
A doctor? A doctor for that? No doctor in the world would know what to do for that. Look, Armitage, it's not human, nor animal. Where did it come from? Can you tell me? Can you tell me what it is?
No, I couldn't tell what Wilbur Whately was. A thing that lay half bent on its side in a pool of greenish-yellow stickiness was 9 feet tall. And the dog had torn off all the clothing and some of the skin. It was partly human, beyond a doubt, with very man-like hands and head, but the torso and lower parts of the body were fabulous. Its chest had the leathery hide of a crocodile or alligator. But below the waistline, the skin was covered with coarse black fur. And from the abdomen, long greenish-gray tentacles. The limbs terminated in ridgy-veined pads that were neither hooves nor claws. And as Dr. Rice and I stood staring at this presence, the whippoorwills began to cry in unison outside the study window. And then the thing on the floor roused and mumbled.
God, sucker.
Armitage, in heaven's name.
Listen. The whippoorwill. Listen. Yes, he's dead now. Look. Look, Rice. Look what's happening.
He's disintegrating.
Of course. Fast, too. Fading away. Because he isn't made of matter as we know it on Earth. I guess he took after his father, so there'll be nothing left.
His father? What was his father?
I daren't think.
Don't worry. We'll bring you the conclusion of this tale of terror. Shortly. Of course, there's always the vexed question of what do we really mean by horror? I remember no less an authority than Peter Cushing, another one of the gentlemen of horror, along with Boris Karloff and Christopher Lee and Vincent Price, once remarked in an interview when asked by an interviewer this very question. He remarked that the kind of films he appeared in weren't really horror films. They were merely more dark fantasies. They were the kind of safe feeling of horror or terror one gets on a roller coaster ride. You know, really, there's nothing really terrible happening. You know that you're really safe, but it allows you to be thrilled. Whilst knowing that nothing terrible really is going to happen. And he went on to point out that really, if we're talking horrific, what you really mean is something like the scene in The Godfather of the severed horse's head in the bed. That's horrific. Dracula, truly, in his deeds, is perhaps not really horrific, nor is Frankenstein building his monsters. We know they're not real. And that was part of my love, particularly of the old Universal horror films. They did come over like some kind of nightmarish fairy tales, especially the use of the studio sets, giving that slightly surreal look to them, stylized surreal look. The tradition carried on by Hammer, although their horror, gothic horror films were perhaps even darker in fantastic terms, with a tinge of forbidden sexuality to them, which fitted the era in which they were made and the audiences they were made for, when one still couldn't talk overtly about sex in mainstream films. So they had analogies for it in vampirism and other monsters. The unrequited lusts of the mummy, for instance. But yes, horror. For our friend H.P. Lovecraft, of course, horror was arguably other people. I mean, certainly a Freudian would have a field day with his the creatures that keep turning up in Lovecraft's oeuvre, as people are revealed to be masses of writhing tentacles and so on. But that's the point with Lovecraft, it's that otherness which is horrific. That's what's meant to be terrifying. One looks at Lovecraft's body of work and his personal letters, his communications, you'll find this the man was basically very reclusive. He had a long friendship with Robert E. Howard of Conan the Barbarian fame, but they never actually met. It was all conducted in letters. Basically, Lovecraft was wary of the rest of humanity, often seeing himself as being somewhat above them. Certainly you'll find in his works, as is typical of many people of his time, references to derogatory references to other races, horror at the idea of miscegenation, as they would call it then. So as I say, that's not surprising that in Lovecraft, horror is equated with otherness, with these strange, horrible beings of the Cthulhu mythos who come from outside and corrupt the very flesh of the people they come into contact with. People are reduced to oozing masses of matter, often all horrible tentacled things upon the suffer terrible mutations. But there you are, horror as the other.
I thought then that what came into our world with Wilbur Whately left with him. I forgot what he himself had told me of it, which was waiting in the sealed house Wizard Whately had built, where the cattle were driven to disappear. But Wilbur Whately left a diary, written in a strange alphabet resembling Sanskrit. And I worked off and on for weeks to decipher it. And finally, I read the following passage written by Wilbur when he was no more than 8 years old.
That upstairs is more ahead of me than I had thought it would be, and is not like to have much earth brain. I can see it a little when I make the sign or blow the powder of Ivangatze at it. And it is like them I see Halloween on the hill. I wonder how I shall look when the earth is cleared and there are no earth beings. Maybe like that upstairs looks, which has no body, even fed with all the blood.
Toward morning, in a cold sweat of terror, I called Dr. Rice to my house and told him, we have to destroy what's in that farmhouse.
Why can't we just leave the thing locked up there? The house is boarded tight.
Yes, but do you think boards will hold it? Don't you realize, man, it hasn't been fed? It hasn't had blood since the 18th of September, when Wilbur Whately came here to die. We left for Dunwich that night, and we've been here on Sentinel Hill ever since, working desperately to discover the formula in time. But a week ago tonight, shortly after dawn... Yeah, hello?
Dr. Armitage, this is Lem Brown. I was just up beyond the glen, Doctor, looking for cows I lost last night.
Yes, Lem?
Well, Doctor, something's been there. Smells like thunder, and there's prints in the road, great round prints, big as barrel heads, like an elephant has been along.
Anything else, Lem?
That's all I see. Except bushes and trees pushed back from the road like a house was drug along.
Did you hear anything?
Yes. Long toward morning, I heard a sound over toward Whateley's place, a kind of ripping or tearing of wood, like a big box was being opened up. Chancy, he heard it too.
Lem, who lives nearest the Whateley farm?
Why, that'd be Elmer Fry's place.
Oh, he's on this line too, isn't he? Hang on and I'll ring him.
Yes, Dr. Armitage, this is Central.
I'm trying to get Elmer Fry, Central.
Doctor, he must be out somewheres, and his whole family. I was ringing there an hour ago. Earl Sawyer saw Elmer's cows stampeding in Cold Spring Glen.
Oh, you didn't get him. All right. But if you hear or see anything more, let me know. I'll be here working all day. Rice! Rice! Wake up! It's loose. It's out of the house. One family gone already. We have to work. Pray God we find that formula in time. It broke loose. A week of terror and panic here in Dunwich Township. Each night it moves about the countryside, leaving the trees crushed in a 30-foot swathe as though by a moving mountain, leaving its monstrous tracks and a trail of tarry stickiness, leaving crushed and gutted farmhouses and whole herds of cattle drained of blood. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is the story to this moment. And tonight is Halloween. Tonight we are here to... Oh, just one moment, please. Dr. Rice, did you hear something?
With the window closed, no.
Well, we'll throw it open. I thought so. Listen. A sound from 1,000 bending trees. A sound like the sea moving across a forest. Yes. Yes, it's coming here, of course. All Hallows, it comes to Sentinel Hill. Dr. Rice, I'll try the formula and the powder from the altar stone. I want you to stay here at the microphone and report what you see.
Very well, Dr. Armitage.
Oh, wait a minute before I go. To any scientists who may be listening to me, if I fail, there is a possible alternative formula in Falconer's Mystical Formulae of the Middle Ages on page 24. Listen. Well, there are the whippoorwills. I better get out there. Take over, Dr. Rice.
Yes. I'll do as well as I can, Armitage. Good luck. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Armitage is climbing to the top of the hill, to the altar stone. I can see him plainly, for the moon is high and the night clear. Down the hill, toward the dark village, I can see the grasses and shrubbery bending down, marking the monster's ascent. It moves quite fast. And I feel a proximity to phases of being utterly forbidden. Now, Dr. Armitage stands now on the altar stone and is holding the powder which, if the books are correct, will make this thing for an instant visible. It is quite close to him now, perhaps 20 yards or less. He lifts his hands, he flings the powder in a wide arc. I can see... Oh, no! No!
Dr. Rice, come in, Dunwich. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your suspense announcer. Due to condition... Oh, just a moment, please. One moment, please. Dr. Rice, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yes, for a moment I was overcome when I saw... Ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you can hear now the incantation of Dr. Armitage. Listen.
Thank you.
The whippoorwills mean death. And Dr. Armitage is walking back here now. So we know that whatever it was, it is gone. It is dead. We can be thankful indeed. You see, I saw Dr. Armitage.
Yes. Did you? Did you see it, Dr. Rice?
I saw it, Lord, yes.
What did it look like to you?
It looked
here
like something made of squirming ropes, but bigger than a barn and shaped, well, like an egg. And dozens of legs, like barrels that half closed when it stepped, and nothing solid about it, and at least 15 or 20 mouths or trunks opening and closing, but what was it?
Oh, a kind of force that doesn't belong in our part of space. Did you notice the half face on top?
Half face, like a human face.
Yes, very large, but yes, quite human. And quite like Wilbur's, like all the weightless.
Then it was...
That's right. It was Wilbur's twin brother. And you saw what 3 weeks' growth had done. And it was the child of Lavinia's who called its father's name on Sentinel Hill, as Wizard Whately prophesied. You heard it calling, Yog-Sotho. Ladies and gentlemen, this night is over. It is All Saints' Day. May heaven bless us all.
The Dunwich Horror, with Ronald Coleman as your star of suspense. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.
And now, Great Hauntings of the United Kingdom, Episode 28, The Haunted House of Horticulture. When top psychic investigator John Balsack crawled under the front door of 36 Legume Close last Halloween, his face spattered with crushed tomatoes and his clothes smeared with vegetable stains, gibbering about terrifying fruit and vegetable-related supernatural occurrences, he was immediately sectioned under the Mental Health Act. The only survivor of a team of three psychic experts investigating him, the Wokingham House, Balsack also found himself prime suspect in his colleagues' deaths.
It took me months to convince the police that I had nothing to do with Terry and Edna's deaths. I mean, eventually they were dismissed as bizarre accidents, but believe me, they were murdered. Murdered by the evil presence in that house.
The paranormal phenomena at 36 Legume Close, an unassuming-looking 1980s-built residence, had begun earlier that year, when the Spuddocks, a family of vegetarians, moved into the property.
Mr. Spuddocks takes up the story.
Only a few days after we arrived, I was woken up by a loud rattling noise from the roof. I mean, I assumed it was hailstones. But I got up and looked out of the window. I saw the front lawn and driveway covered with onions. I mean, and then when I went out the back, I found the back garden was exactly the same. I mean, it was most peculiar. Not only falling out of a clear sky, but it's only our house which has been affected.
The occurrences seemed to become ever more violent as the year wore on.
We were sat watching a cookery show on the TV one evening in June. I mean, Jamie Oliver was chopping up some vegetables when there was this huge crash and the television exploded. I mean, when I got up and checked, something had smashed through the living room window and crashed into the television. When I sifted through the wreckage, I found a Brussels sprout. Obviously, we thought someone had thrown it from outside, but there was no one in the back garden, and no way anyone could have accessed it.
By September, the haunting took a more sinister turn. The Spuddock's 10-year-old daughter, Abigail, running shrieking from the bathroom one evening.
She'd heard the shower running, and when she looked round the door, the steam-filled bathroom, Abigail saw that the shower curtain had been pulled across the bath. Well, she was naturally curious, and when she pulled it back, there was a giant, man-sized stick of celery standing under the shower. Apparently, the thing lunged towards her as she tried to get out of the bathroom. When I found her on the landing, she was a gibbering wreck.
However, this wasn't to be the 10-year-old's last encounter with the evil forces in the house and looking close.
She kept complaining of hearing strange rustling noises in the night, like leaves. Each night they seemed to come closer to her bed. Finally, one night she felt something heavy land on the bed, followed by the rustling sound right in front of her face. When she switched on the light, there was a huge cabbage just sitting there on the bed. Not surprisingly, she fled the room, screaming, and refused ever to go back.
The Spuddocks now felt they had little choice but to call an expert assistance, and turned to Balzac and his colleagues at the East Berkshire Paranormal Association.
We entered the house on the 30th of October, and the Spuddocks family went to stay with relatives for the duration. For most of that first day, everything was quiet. Only started kicking off that night.
Indeed, it was that evening that Balzac was to have his first encounter with the terrifying evil forces contained within the house. As he lay resting in the upstairs front bedroom.
I was asleep in the front bedroom when I felt something climbing beside me. Obviously, I thought I was dreaming as I felt an apparently female form press its breasts against me. Naturally, I responded, caressing those enormous, round breasts. Then I opened my eyes and recoiled in horror at the terrible travesty of a human being kneeling astride me in bed. Its face was a grinning Halloween pumpkin, topped with cress instead of hair. My hands involuntarily clenched with terror, and it was horrible. I could feel my fingers bursting through the surface of the thing's breasts. It was horrible. I could feel the skin giving way under my fingertips, pushing the disgusting stuff, soft and sticky flesh below. When I looked down at the breasts, I realized they were just a huge pair of glistening melons. Oh, obviously, I screamed at the top of my voice, and the whole thing collapsed into a pile of inanimate vegetables. And at that, all the others came running into the room to see what had happened. And all they found was my sobbing vegetable-strewn body, my fingers smeared with melon.
Things then remained quiet until the following evening, when his colleagues, Edna Sprockler and Terry Clutch, fell victim to the house.
We were eating dinner when I swear that I saw this radish leap off of Edna's plate into her mouth and down her throat. I mean, she went blue in the face and collapsed. There's absolutely nothing I could do. She choked to death in front of me. But then, to make it worse, just as Edna gurgled her last, I heard the scream from upstairs, when I found Terry in one of the bedrooms, sprawled across the bed, naked from the waist down, with a huge marrow jammed up his backside. I mean, to this day, I don't know what went on in that room, but Terry was stone cold dead.
This seemed to be a cue for the whole house to erupt into psychic activity.
Fruit and vegetables started flying everywhere. They seemed to appear out of thin air. I was mercilessly pummeled by flying fruit, but I still managed to stumble back downstairs, where I found that the kitchen seemed to be the epicenter of the disturbance. I could see the strange red light emanating from under the door. I tell you, what I saw when I pushed open that kitchen door filled me with a terror, which I'll never forget for the rest of my life. I mean, there it was, right in front of me, the devil himself in the form of a huge, corned cucumber. That's when I made a break for it, obviously.
Whilst Balzac escaped with his life, his investigation still didn't identify the cause of the disturbances at 36 Legume Close. However, we found an elderly neighbour of the Spuddocks who was subsequently able to cast some light on the mystery.
This old house and estate was built on the site of an old market garden. The fruit and vegetables grown there were kept in terrible conditions, buried up to their stems all day, left at the mercy of the elements. It was horrible. Horrible. I reckon the arrival of them vegetarians from the cruelly chopping up and boiling poor plants was just too much for the tortured souls those poor tormented fruit and vegetables.
As for the Spuddocks, they have since abandoned both the house and their vegetarianism, though eating nothing but meat. Lovecraft, unfortunately, never seems to film well. I remember back in the 1960s when American International Pictures were rapidly running out of Edgar Allan Poe stories they could adapt, they started turning to Lovecraft and produced three Lovecraft-inspired movies. One of them even pretended to be an Edgar Allan Poe adaptation. Roger Corman's The Haunted Palace may have borne the title of a Poe poem and make brief reference to it at the beginning of the film, but actually it was Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. It's an interesting film, trying to combine Lovecraft's themes with the musty atmosphere of the Corman Edgar Allan Poe series, and even featuring that series' lead actor Vincent Price. It's an entertaining film, but quite some way from its source material. Then there was Die Monster Die, a luridly retitled adaptation of The Colour Out of Space, which transplants the action from New England to Old England, Arkham becoming a village somewhere in the south of England. An interesting film with an imported American star, Nick Adams, invented love interest for him, and our old friend Boris Karloff as Nahum Whitley, who unfortunately is suffering some very ill effects from that strange meteorite he has down in his basement. Again, it tries to combine Lovecraft with the mustiness of the Poe series, with most of the action occurring within Karloff's dusty mausoleum of a house, with the sets very reminiscent of the Poe series. Perhaps isn't surprising, as the film was directed by Daniel Haller, who designed the sets for most of the Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe series. And Haller was also behind an adaptation for AIP of the Dunwich Horror, this time shot in the States, but again updated to what was then contemporary times of, I think, 1969. It also made Wilbur Wakeley into a more conventional human villain, and also provided him with a love interest in the form of, I'm going to call rightly, Sandra Dee. Again, it strayed a long way from Lovecraft. It has a certain atmosphere, has a very interesting animated title sequence, and features Ed Begley as Professor Armitage. And the climax is quite well done, with the monstrous twin brother quite well realised. But to be frank, I really don't think it was a patch on this 1945 adaptation for the radio that we've just heard, which is, in my opinion, one of the finest Lovecraft adaptations I've ever heard. But there you are. They knew how to make him in those days. I mean, that was made contemporary. That production was a contemporary of movies like The House of Frankenstein and The House of Dracula. They knew how to do it in those days. Well, we're nearly at the end now. I mean, that's about it for this edition of the Sleazecast. Just emphasize, reiterate, as I always do, that as far as I'm aware, all the materials I've used here lie in the public domain. My apologies to anyone if I have infringed their copyright, and please let me know, and obviously I'll try and rectify that situation. But all that remains now, before we go, is to hear once more from DJ Dr. Toast, this time with a little concoction of his entitled Haunted House Party. Who's there this time of night? Just excuse me, I'm just going to see you there. Just bear with me for a minute.
Ah, but here come our other guests.